You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Tonight's show is being underwritten by the American Postal Workers Union, Local 67, and Blake and Ulig, PA. American Postal Workers Union, Local 67, asks all of our labor brothers and sisters to make an effort to spread the word that union issues and legislation that may affect working families. Take the time to be aware of the issues we face in Congress and who our enemies are. Please make sure all your families and friends are registered to vote in their present county and know where their voting place is. Our strength has always and will be in solidarity. And Blake and Ulig, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, candidate Trump said NAFTA was the worst trade agreement ever and promised to fix it and bring jobs back to the USA. We'll find out from the Citizens Trade Campaign just what Trump gets wrong about trade. Then, we'll challenge you to relearn American history as we talk about what they didn't teach you in school about Black and Latinx history. In the news, the right-wing Mackinac Center says it believes in choice, but it's not what you think. And five senators tell AT&T CEO to stop offshoring jobs. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Aereo, with headlines of, Is Ohio Meatpacking Company Preying on Workers? What does a farm bill have to do with threatening chemical plant safety? And EPA gives thumbs up to new uses of asbestos. Oh, goody. Now for the news.
The Huffington Post reports the Supreme Court's recent landmark ruling, Janus versus AFSCME, on union fees, was not even a day old when public school teachers in Rochester, New York, received a related email through their work accounts. The subject line read, New York union members now have a choice in paying dues. The message came from the Mackinac Center, a Michigan-based conservative group that has pushed right to work and other anti-union legislation over the years. It steered recipients to an online opt-out form they could use to leave their union, which is an affiliate of the American Federation of Teachers. The email was one of many efforts by right-wing groups that started even before Janus. The Mackinac Center's Lindsay Killen said the group plans to outreach in all 22 states that allowed fair share fees, which are now illegal because of the Supreme Court decision. They've earmarked $10 million for this year's campaign with lots of online advertising and direct mail and targeted emails to union members. They get workers' contact information through public records requests. Right after the decision, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said he will issue an executive order barring release of public sector workers' information. Mackinac gets funding from Education Secretary Betsy DeVos and her husband Dick. Killen insists that she's not telling workers to drop out, only that they now have a choice. That claim, however, is belied by the email to the Rochester workers, which gave workers reasons to drop out of their union and steered them to a page to drop out. The Americans for Prosperity Foundation, which was founded by conservative megadonor David Koch, is also launching a Janus-inspired campaign in New Hampshire, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Illinois, Minnesota, New Mexico, and Alaska. They also say they just want workers to know they have a choice.
A report issued by the OECD, that's the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, which is made up of 36 nations, mostly the world's richest, but with a few not so rich like Mexico. The report states that while unemployment has reached record lows in some OECD countries, wages continue to stagnate. Unless countries can break this cycle, public belief in the recovery will be undermined and labor market inequality will widen. The report says that for the first time, there are more people with a job today than before the Great Recession, which began over a decade ago. Some of the strongest improvements occurred among disadvantaged groups such as older workers, mothers with young children, youth, and immigrants. Despite the good news, the picture continues to be mixed in terms of jobs quality and security, while poverty has grown among the working age population, reaching 10.6% in 2015 compared to 9.6% a decade earlier, and wage growth remains remarkably more sluggish than before the financial crisis. At the end of 2017, nominal wage growth in the OECD area was only half of what it was in 2007, when the average of unemployment rates of OECD countries was about the same as now. The average nominal wage growth was 5.8% versus 3.2% the last quarter of 2017. More worryingly, wage stagnation affects low-paid workers much more than those at the top. OECD Secretary General Angel Gurría unveiled the report in Paris and said, "This trend of wageless growth in the face of a rise of employment highlights the structural changes in our economies that the global crisis has deepened, and it underlines the urgent need for countries to help workers, especially the low-skilled." The report attributes wage stagnation to low inflation and a major slowdown in productivity growth, as well as a rise in low-paying jobs. The Outlook notes a significant It notes a significant worsening in the average earnings of part-time workers relative to full-time workers. Declining coverage of unemployment benefits in many countries and persisting long-term unemployment may also have contributed. Fewer than one in three job seekers receive unemployment benefits on average across the OECD. And the longer-term downward trend of benefit coverage has continued in many countries since the crisis. In addition, the report says there's a lack of high-quality education and training systems, and says that there's new evidence that shows that coordinated collective bargaining systems, partnerships with management and labor, and mediation contribute to high levels of employment. A better quality work environment, including more training opportunities and great resilience of the labor market to shocks. In other words, more unions, better collective bargaining, better employment, and all of those other good indicators of an economy.
PAI reports that with 14,000 telecom workers ever closer to being forced to strike, groups of House and Senate Democrats are demanding that Randall Stephenson, CEO of AT&T, both end call center cuts and settle with communications workers, who represent the employees at AT&T Midwest and Legacy T, two of the giant firm's subsidiaries. Key issues which may force CWA members to walk are the two companies' continued outsourcing of U.S. jobs and the raises Stevenson promised after the telecom enthusiastically supported and benefited from the Trump GOP tax cut for corporations and the rich. Stevenson had promised $1,000 each. CWA, citing GOP President Donald Trump's prior claims, said each worker should get $4,000 immediately. The CWA executive board previously authorized union leaders to call a strike if necessary. The firm's contracts with both subsidiaries expired in April. Now, five Democratic senators, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, Dick Durbin and Tammy Duckworth of Illinois, Tammy Baldwin of Wisconsin, and Joe Donnelly of Indiana, have written Stevenson, reminding him of his job creation promise made after Congress gave their huge tax cuts last year. Instead, Stevenson is still cutting call center jobs, particularly in the Midwest. The lawmakers noticed Stevenson predicted that AT&T would gain $1 billion from the tax cut, adding he promised last November 8th it would create 7,000 new jobs system-wide as a result. They also quoted Representative Mike Kelly, Republican from Pennsylvania, as saying the tax cut would bring home and or retain 36,000 jobs in Pennsylvania alone. The senator said, "As we consider future taxing and spending priorities, we ask if you would update us on the status of your plans to invest in the United States, as well as other seen and unseen impacts the tax law has had on your business priorities." They want an answer by July 23rd. The news tonight was read by Greg Swartz, Judy Ansel, and I'm Jen Zaman.
Was 8 years old, running with a dime in my hand, to the bus stop to pick up a paper for my old man. I sit on his lap in that big old Buick and steer as we drove through town. He'd tassel my hair and say, "Son, take a good look around. This is your hometown. This is your hometown."
Hi, this is Judy Ansel. The coming trade war is all over the news. Just on Monday, the Kansas City Star went front page with an article on a crisis for soybean farmers, prices dropping, and opinions from people they call Missouri influencers. One, Diane Lynch, president of Stevens College, warned, quote, "Missouri jobs and industries can't become the collateral damage of Trump's global trade strategies." Congressman Emanuel Cleaver thinks people don't realize how much ag business is connected to the Kansas City economy. He said, "I don't know if people in our community understand the hit we're about to take." But then again, Granite City Steel, just across the Mississippi from St. Louis, is going to reopen because of the steel and aluminum tariffs Trump slapped on, especially China. At the same time as the NAFTA renegotiations bogged down amidst political change in Mexico and insults thrown at Canada, there's more alarm. Will Trump just cancel the free trade agreement that has caused so many workers so much grief? And is that the solution? Trump's threat to can NAFTA and his tariffs are popular with many union members, especially those in the Rust Belt. The Democrats, of course, are of two minds. The corporate Dems always liked free trade and hate tariffs, and they've been helping seed the panic about the trade war threat. Left-leaning Democrats haven't gotten much press, but we wonder whether Trump and thus Republicans are stealing the trade issue from the Democrats. Our guest tonight says that there's an absence of voices criticizing Trump's trade policies from the left. He's Arthur Stamoulis, and he's the Citizens Trade Campaign Executive Director. The CTC facilitates the formation of cross-sectoral coalitions in which diverse interests can come together to share strategy, coordinate advocacy efforts, and promote an alternative vision to the neoliberal model of globalization. Welcome to the show, Arthur.
Thanks for having me.
I hope I pronounced your last name right. What? How do you say it?
It's Arthur Stamoulis.
Okay. It sounds Greek.
It is.
Okay. And you've been there for quite a while, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. I started in 2011.
first off, would you tell us what the Citizens Trade Campaign's position is on trade agreements like NAFTA and the WTO, especially in regard to their effect on jobs and income equality and, you know, working class kinds of issues?
Yeah, we don't like NAFTA, and we don't like the WTO the way that they've unfolded in recent decades. You know, these are trade agreements that make it easier for big corporations to ship jobs around the world to wherever working people are the most exploited and environmental regulations are the weakest. So the U.S. Labor Department has certified almost 1 million individual U.S. jobs as lost to NAFTA under just one narrow government program, and millions more livelihoods have been destroyed, in particular thanks to China's entry into the WTO and other subsequent NAFTA-style trade agreements. We've seen, you know, millions of jobs outsourced. We're seeing more and more jobs outsourced every week as a result of these pacts. And even if you're someone, you know, in a profession that can't easily be outsourced, say you're a firefighter or you're a home care provider or something like that, all this trade-related job loss is still driving down the wages and the jobs that are left. One study estimates the net cost in lost income to the majority of American workers is around $3,300 each year, you know, roughly 12% of people's income, even after taking into the account of, you know, savings from cheaper imported goods. You know, so these are pacts that are outsourcing jobs and are causing the jobs that are left to pay less. So we're seeing them as severely damaging to American workers, but they've also been damaging to people around the world.
You also say that actually trade agreements have cost the U.S. working class more than even technology, right?
Yeah, it's not just us who said that. There have been major studies on that. Certainly, you know, technology costs jobs in certain sectors, but the rise in income inequality has been much more driven by all this outsourcing and wage suppression caused by our trade policy.
So let's switch and talk about Donald Trump. When he ran for office, he talked a lot about trade agreements, especially NAFTA. He said, I think it was the worst trade agreement we'd ever negotiated or something. He was pretty hyperbolic about it. What did he promise voters he was going to do?
So Donald Trump promised voters that he was going to either fix or eliminate NAFTA for working people on day one. You know, that he was going to bring back American jobs and raise American wages. You know, thus far, he's taken some actions on trade, but he certainly hasn't achieved the end that he's promised. You know, he's been renegotiating NAFTA and he's been in office for, you know, about a year and a half now, and still hasn't even endorsed the common sense labor and environmental standards that would prevent the jobs from being outsourced, that would protect worker rights abroad, and that would raise wages, you know, across the continent. The first common sense thing you would do if you were trying to have a deal that benefited jobs and benefited wages. So, you know, he's made some steps, but he definitely hasn't gone as far as is really needed to protect jobs and wages.
He did, though, pretty effectively steal the trade issue from Hillary. Do you think that's right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if he stole it from Hillary, but he certainly stole it from Democrats.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, over the years, it's been congressional Democrats who fought against these trade agreements, you know, more than any other sort of political group. And Donald Trump, you know, was out there. He was talking about the hurt caused by these trade deals, you know, and said he had a plan to fix them, whether or not he really does. And I think he got, you know, he got a lot of credit from that among certain segments of the voting populace.
Right. Yeah. Especially those proverbial Rust Belt white guys who feel really threatened with deindustrialization and offshoring of jobs. You know, I've been saying this ever since he got elected, that he's wrong on, you know, he may have some correct positions or criticisms, but his reasoning is all wrong because he blamed other countries for NAFTA when, in fact, you know, NAFTA is a creature of multinational corporations. And you, of course, said that in your article that I read. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, no. I mean, Donald Trump likes to paint NAFTA as a question of the U.S. versus Mexico and Canada rather than an issue of greedy corporations against all of us, right? I mean, he, you know, is constantly out there claiming that Mexico and Canada pulled a fast one on the United States and are bad negotiators, that these other countries won and we lost and that they're laughing at us, which is absurd. I mean, we've talked about how awful NAFTA has been for U.S. workers, and it has been. But it has been just as bad as for Canadian workers and even worse for Mexican workers.
Right.
Under NAFTA, millions of rural Mexicans were forced off their land when cheap taxpayer subsidized corn and other agricultural products flooded into Mexico tariff-free once NAFTA was enacted. After that, approximately 28,000 small and medium-sized Mexican employers went under when companies like Walmart moved into the country. Mm. So you couple all this with the ongoing suppression of labor rights in Mexico, and the average real wage for manufacturing workers in Mexico is almost 10% less today than it was the year before NAFTA took effect about a quarter century ago. So this has been a disaster for Mexican workers. It's been, as bad for Canadian workers as it has been for American workers. And, Donald Trump likes to blame foreigners for this when it's really, Wall Street CEOs, K Street lobbyists who pushed these policies and continue to push these policies to this day.
Well, I'm really relieved to find out that Justin Trudeau wasn't really the bad guy, but I'm more interested.
He's one of the bad guys.
Yeah, he is one of the bad guys, right?
Not a friend, but he's not being criticized for the right reason.
Right, but if Trump were to actually recognize what NAFTA did to Mexican workers, he might have to be a little more sympathetic about the refugees from NAFTA, meaning the immigrants who are trying to cross our border. And I think that would probably go for the CAFTA, Central America Free Trade Agreement, as well. That it has
Absolutely.
It has played a role in driving people and dislocating people out of their countries. And
immigration from Mexico doubled under the first year of NAFTA. NAFTA was promised to lift living standards and wages in Mexico. The Clinton administration at the time, the Bill Clinton administration, argued that it was going to, I believe, cut immigration from Mexico by 2/3 within the first decade. Well, actually, it doubled within the first decade under NAFTA. And then CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, did the same thing to, Honduras and El Salvador and other countries in Central America. And that economic displacement has certainly forced many, many people to risk their lives crossing the border, in hopes for a better life here. And Donald Trump doesn't get that at all.
So is there anything that his administration gets right in the NAFTA renegotiations? Are they pushing for anything that's going to be helpful to American, Mexican, and Canadian workers?
Certainly his trade negotiator, Robert Lighthizer, does have some ideas that we agree with. In particular, he has opposed investor state dispute settlement, ISDS, which is a provision that allows multinational corporations to use NAFTA to challenge countries' labor laws, their environmental laws, any other sort of public interest law that cuts into their expectation profits, and has actually served as an outsourcing incentive for companies here to move abroad because it's safer and easier for them to not have to worry that, hey, look, there's going to be some new environmental law that's going to cut into my profits if I build, a new refinery or a factory overseas. So he's opposed ISDS. We definitely support that. He said some interesting things about improving rules of origin, basically closing the loopholes that allow products that are made in third-party countries like China to enter the United States duty-free by having the majority of the parts of a car or a computer be made in a country like China and then assembled in Mexico and into the U.S. duty-free. So we agree with that. But again, what they haven't fully embraced yet is the strong labor and environmental standards, which are, again, the first thing you would do to protect jobs at home, protect worker rights abroad, and raise wages across borders. And that's one of the things we're pushing really hard for right now.
Do you think the election of Manuel López Obrador in Mexico as their new president, AMLO, might make a difference in Mexico's position on raising wages and having higher labor standards?
We certainly hope so. AMLO has been, again, sort of a champion for the poor in Mexico. He's been a champion for family farmers in Mexico. and we hope that he will support, you know, strong labor and environmental standards in NAFTA, raises the minimum wage in Mexico. I will say he, you know, definitely tried to make overtures to the corporate world and the international corporate community during his campaign, basically saying, hey, if Peña Nieto negotiates a NAFTA deal before I'm in office during this long lame-duck period that they had in Mexico, I'll have to live with that, which wasn't what we wanted to hear. But hopefully, once he gets into office, he'll be willing to move further than any previous Mexican administration has.
Oh, that's actually pretty scary, but we'll see. Okay, I want to shift and talk about this threat of a trade war because of Trump's tariffs. And I realize that your organization hasn't been very much involved in that issue in particular, but you certainly are concerned with trade agreements. Do you think the threat of a trade war is real?
I'm glad that there's attention being paid finally to the U.S. trade deficit. You know, as we said, there's been millions of jobs outsourced, creating a very real downward pressure on the wages and benefits of jobs that are left, and it needs to be addressed. In our minds, you know, the ultimate solution is with much better transformative trade policies, not just, you know, better enforcement of the policies that we already have. That said, you know, if you look at something like steel and aluminum, you know, the impact of, in particular, Chinese dumping on the steel and aluminum industry is very real. We're seeing steel and aluminum plants closed, you know, decade after decade. And real action is needed now to protect those industries. The question, you know, that I would have is, like, how are these policies being unrolled? Are they being unrolled in a way where we're bringing in allies to work together and focus pressure on the worst actors, namely the Chinese government? Are we doing it in a way that, you know, leads to more retaliatory tariffs and, you know, it becomes unclear what paths we're going to go down and how much harm is going to be placed on consumers, you know, and producers like. You know, these are questions. We don't oppose tariffs. We think tariffs are an important tool, but they're a means to an end and an end to themselves.
One of the things you said in your article was that the left has been kind of silent on this, on the issues of Trump and trade. And, you know, I looked up positions of Rust Belt Democrats, and Sherrod Brown, senator from Ohio, basically agrees with what Trump's doing, at least on the aluminum and steel. And then Marcy Kaptur, who's been, you know, famous for years for opposing these free trade agreements, she's also a congressperson from Ohio. She is somewhat critical of Trump for, you know, kind of hitting the whole issue with a sledgehammer instead of targeting the sanctions, particularly against China and Russia. Can you explain, first off, can you elaborate more on the silence of sort of the left? But also, can you explain what it is that China does on steel?
Yeah, so on steel and aluminum in particular, what they do is the government, because it's a state-run economy, largely subsidizes these steel and aluminum plants such that there's a global oversupply of steel and aluminum, and then they sell it for less than the cost of production on the international market, particularly here in the United States. And so that undercut employers here, and it destroys good-paying union-wage jobs. Meanwhile, they also, to get around tariffs placed just on China, will invest in the steel and aluminum businesses in other countries, or transship their products through other countries so that, you know, just putting the tariffs on China alone becomes, very easy to evade.
I see.
It is a real problem.
Let me just interrupt you a sec. Yeah, because we could do the same thing as China does. We could have an industrial policy that invested in our steel industry and subsidized it. Wouldn't that be an alternative?
I think certainly we should have industrial policy in this country, not just for steel and aluminum, but for
right.
all sorts of development, and in my mind, ideally for green development. Let's switch to a carbon-neutral economy that protects the environment and creates jobs, you know, and raises wages for people across the board. I mean, that's absolutely something we should be doing. It's something that is anathema to the World Trade Organization and sort of this model of you know, hey, let's let the market dictate how the economy is shaped. Yeah, absolutely, we should do that. I mean, the question of steel and aluminum in particular, I mean, the problem is we have a global oversupply. We have more than we need. Uh-huh. So, you know, more subsidy for more production might not be the right answer there. But again, I'm not, you know, particularly an expert in that issue.
Right. But I just wanted to point out that it's the neoliberal rules of trade, the so-called free trade doctrine, that has got us into this mess. And because the Chinese have at least a history of a different system, you know, they're not abiding by those same rules. And yeah, they're hypocritical because they agreed to the rules. But on the other hand, maybe we should just change our model for doing trade.
I mean, ultimately, yes, we need to change the model. And, you know, I mean, not just have an industrial policy here, which, you know, they not only have in China, but they have in Germany, Europe, right, and in most of the world. You know, but we also, I mean, the main thing that we push for, you know, is improvements of worker rights, improvements of environmental rights, you know, and making sure that working people have a voice and are seeing some of the benefits of this global economy that we live in.
What a radical idea.
It's not just going to elites. Yeah, it's not just going to elites here or in China, but it's actually being shared more broadly.
Okay, we're just about out of time, Arthur. Can you just very briefly comment on what do you think the Democrats should do?
I think Democrats should be out there front and center criticizing Trump, you know, not just for what he's doing on the trade issue, but for what he hasn't done. Mm-hmm. In particular, not championing labor and environmental standards, which are ultimately what we need if we're going to protect jobs at home, protect, you know, working rights abroad, and raise wages economy-wide.
Yeah. We'll have to leave it at that. We've been talking to Arthur Stamoulis from the Citizens Trade Campaign. Thanks. Thank you so much, Arthur.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Did you know that you can donate that unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling 866-628-2277.
There will be a Kansas Candidate for Governor's Forum this Saturday, July 7th from 12:30 to 2:30 p.m. at the Johnson County Central Resource Library at 9875 87th Street, Overland Park, Kansas. Come meet the candidates, learn their position on the issues. That's Kansas Governor Forum this Saturday, 12:30 p.m. at Johnson County Central Resource Library on 87th Street in Overland Park, Kansas. This has been a Kansas City Community Radio public service announcement.
Delgadina se paseaba por su sala muy cuadrada, con su manto de hilo de oro que en su pecho iluminaba. Levántate, Delgadina, vístete de puro blanco para ir los dos a misa a la ciudad de Durango. Se levantó, Delgadina, se vistió de puro blanco y se fueron para misa a la ciudad de Durango. Delgadina estaba hincada rezando sus oraciones, sin saber que ya su papá traía malas intenciones. Cuando salieron de misa, su papá le...
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. This is Jacob White. Joining me today is historian Paul Ortiz. He is a historian at the University of Florida, and we're going to talk about his new book, which is An African American and Latinx History of the United States. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Jacob, for having me on. It's a real honor and pleasure.
Awesome. This is a labor show. We're get some sponsorship from unions, and we're on community radio. And, you know, you mentioned in your introduction how your involvement in the labor movement, it played some role in inspiring your scholarship. So I was wondering, you know, it's interesting, sometimes we have organizers on, sometimes we have historians or political scientists on. You're a little bit of both, so I was wondering if you could tell us about your organizing background before we get into the book.
Yes, thank you. Well, my organizing background really was the thing that led me into writing this book. I worked as an organizer with the United Farm Workers of Washington State on the Chateau Saint Michel boycott. Some of your listeners will be well aware of. That was an 8-year, this epic struggle involving a group of vineyard workers, great vineyard workers in eastern Washington in the late 80s, early 90s. And that's where I really learned the nuts and bolts of labor organizing. And it also led me into dealing with a number of questions. You know, one, why is labor oppression so deeply ingrained in U.S. American society? Because the conditions that a lot of the workers I was working with, and then later when I worked as a volunteer organizer with the Farm Labor Organizing Committee when I was in graduate school in North Carolina, and working with different, you know, going to labor camps, seeing migrant workers really subjected to conditions akin to servitude. Some of the workers in eastern North Carolina camps actually could not leave their labor camps without being subjected to extreme violence. And so, and then growing up in a working class environment, I grew up in a town called Bremerton, Washington. Some of your listeners might be familiar with Bremerton as one of the major shipyard towns for the Navy. And we grew up working class. And in fact, I very rarely ever heard the term middle class. It actually wasn't until college, many years later, that I heard the term. But growing up in that environment, you know, being in the labor movement and seeing the reality of the U.S. is very different than the way it's presented in textbooks. Like when I got to college, I was astonished because I'd read things like, you know, the United States is a middle-class republic. And I would say, wow, not in my experience, nor in the experience I had as a labor organizer. Or the textbook would say the U.S. is the freest country on earth. And I would think, again, from a working-class perspective, from a brown and black perspective, untrue, you know, definitely untrue. And so those are things which really propelled me, I think, into graduate school. I went to Duke, and I started in 93. I was working with people like Alex Kasar, Leon Fink, Nancy Hewitt, tremendous labor historians who gave me the freedom to combine, you know, my organizing and kind of working class experience with my scholarship. So that was really, they were the ones who really kind of gave me permission to do that.
Your book is, it's very sort of international. It is a history of the United States, but you really bring it into an international perspective. Earlier this year, we had on Dr. Gerald Horn, and he just wrote a book about the Caribbean and the East Coast before, you know, during the colonial period. And I saw a lot of similarities some overlap in the material you cover that is just totally ignored in the high school and even in some college curricula. So what about your international experience? I know you also mentioned in the book that you have a military background, and how does that come to influence your scholarship as well?
Yes. Well, first of all, Gerald Horn is one of my mentors, and he's a guide and a role model for all of us who do social history, you know, social justice research. He's a prolific author, and if you look at the footnotes of my book, you will see a number of different Gerald Horn books. He's just a tremendous scholar. And I'm glad you asked the question, Jacob, because I came to the understanding when I was working on this book. I should say, you know, this is kind of my second and a half book, if you will. So I was a co-editor for a book called Remembering Jim Crow, Oral Histories of African Americans in the Jim Crow South. And then I wrote a book called Emancipation to Trade, which is a book about the Black freedom struggle, especially in Florida. Now, this book, I really began to look back on my experiences in the military. So I was in U.S. Special Forces in Central America in the mid-80s. And this was the first time in my life, as a very young man, we're talking about these are years that precede even my labor history experience. It took me many years to process what I was part of in Central America. In the mid-80s, it led me to realize that one cannot really write U.S. history unless you're able to leave the country and look at it from outside in. to talk to people, especially people in the Global South who've experienced a very different United States from the one that we're fed to on the mainstream media and in our colleges still to this day. And so I feel like you either have to be able to leave physically like I did, or at least imaginatively. I mean, what does it mean to really pursue the truth and get to the objective standpoint? The objective standpoint is not the U.S. as a light upon nations. It's not the U.S. as a beacon on the hill. It's not the U.S. as the last best hope on earth. These are things that people like, you know, President Barack Obama and President Trump actually share in common. They share a belief in American exceptionalism. But going abroad and being a soldier and seeing, you know, civil wars, seeing the U.S. support these civil wars, trying to figure out, you know, as a 20-year-old sergeant in Special Forces, I have no idea what the geopolitics are. But as I got older and went back to those experiences, this is a wake-up call. And I'll tell one story that involved experience and scholarship and kind of combines them. So when I first went to Central America in 84, I began to encounter this character who was, you know, he was everywhere. He's ubiquitous. Wherever I went in Central America, I would see quotes by him. I would see images, graffiti. And the person, of course, was Augusto Sandino. Mm-hmm. He was a person who, I mean, Sandino was incredibly inspirational to liberation and freedom fighters in the 1980s and since that time and before that time. But to show you how naive and how nationalistic my historical background was, I thought Augusto Sandino was still alive. Mm. And this is 1984. It's kind of embarrassing to mention, but he was everywhere. And so later when I found out, no, he had died many, many years earlier, in part fighting, you know, for his people's freedom against U.S. occupation and oppression, years later in the archives, I encountered Augusto Sandino again. This time, I read about him in newspapers. And I read about him in the New York Times and the Washington Post and others. The New York Times in particular saw Sandino as a terrorist, depicted him as a robber, as a common thug. But when I looked at black newspapers, it is remarkable how different Sandino was presented. There, he was presented as a freedom fighter. In black newspapers like the Norfolk Journal and Guide, the Pittsburgh Courier, Augusto Sandino is a hero to his people, and that's how he was depicted. And many black editors would write, Augusto, they would say things like, you know, if you think George Washington was a hero, Augusto Sandino was even more of a hero to his people. And when the U.S. finally prevailed in Central America in the 1920s, the black press wrote, this is a victory that we should be ashamed of, because the people that we're fighting are people who we should be on the side of, actually. So I think those things kind of really come together. We've got to have an internationalist vision of U.S. history, because as long as we continue to have the nationalist vision, we're going to get people like Donald Trump. We're going to get people like Jeff Sessions. We're going to get people who are leaders who have no connection to the outside world, who want us as Americans to build walls. Right? You know, tariff walls, you know, physical walls, so on and so forth. We've got to understand the U.S. is part of a broader, you know, global community.
Part of the way that you do that in this book is by sort of talking about, it's a history of the United States, but it's also, it talks about where people have taken refuge when the United States got to be too much for them. And I know a very famous one, and one that Dr. Horn talks about, is Jack Johnson, who was actually pardoned recently, surprisingly, by President Trump. But could you talk a little bit also about that, about how, like, in the American imagination, we sort of see, like, Canada as being the main refuge, but in reality, if you want to look at where American dissidents go, you have to sort of look at the whole hemisphere.
Well, yeah, if you're talking on labor history, you know, enslaved African-American workers or slaves, Mexico abolishes slavery in 1821. In reality, which is the year that it finally, you know, wins its independence, more or less, from Spain. But even before that, African-American slaves would escape to the South, to Mexico, to find sanctuary. And this is a big theme in African-American history. People like Langston Hughes, for example, his father became a successful businessman in Mexico because he said, you know, the Negro has much more of a future in Mexico than he does in the United States. And so Langston Hughes actually wrote the Negro Speaks of Rivers on his way on a train trip into Mexico to visit with his father. Elizabeth Catlett, the great African-American artist, really had to leave the U.S. because of McCarthyism and then became a tremendous art figure in Mexico City. You mentioned Jack Johnson, the list goes on and on. We're taught to see the Underground Railroad as something where African-Americans found sanctuary in Canada. And yes, that's true, but the recent scholarship, and again, Gerald Horn and others have demonstrated that probably an equal number, or maybe greater, a number of African-Americans find refuge and sanctuary in places like Mexico, in places like Haiti. Even in the former British Empire, places like Trinidad, the Bahamas, the distinctive thing about U.S. history in the 19th century is that it's an expanding slave empire surrounded by nations and peoples abolishing slavery. Now we're talking about most Native American nations like the Seminoles. We're talking about the French Empire, the British Empire, you know, foremost, of course, the Haitian Republic, the first independent, first free independent republic in the Western Hemisphere, and Mexico. And so African Americans and freedom-loving people are able to find sanctuary in one or more of these countries after generations. It's astonishing. I teach my students. I have a lot of Cuban-American students at the University of Florida, and they're astonished to discover that people like Antonio Maceo and Jose Marti and the great liberation fighters from Cuba all found sanctuary in Haiti over a very long period of time. The first time the Venezuelan flag was actually flown was not in Venezuela, because the Spanish would have executed anyone daring enough to fly it. It was actually flown in Jacmel Bay in Haiti because the Haitians had created this incredible, they called it, you know, oppressed people looked at Haiti and Mexico as beacons of liberty. To people in power in the U.S., Haiti and Mexico have always been public enemies number one. And American authorities, and I'm sad to say, too many scholars have played along in either vilifying openly or implicitly countries like Haiti and Mexico. We should be celebrating them. Haiti is the country which establishes the idea of equality between nations and within nations. At the same time, the U.S. is trying to occupy their nations militarily. So, yes, we've got to understand that these ideas of freedom are coming from the global South. And I'm relying upon, you know, both my own research, but also people like Greg Grandin, people like Howard Zinn. You know, a lot of folks, who also were military veterans who went abroad and saw the world, I think, in a more nuanced sense.
Speaking of nuance, and we only have about 3 or 4 minutes left, so I know we don't have that much time to get into it, but this is it's a black and brown history of the United States, and I saw an interesting tweet the other day, actually, that was, it said, like, more than half, and I don't know if this is necessarily correct, but it was an interesting thought, but it said more than half of the people who have been deported by, you know, U.S. Border authorities are Afro-descent. They come from an African background, and that as much as it is a Latino issue, it's also an African or an African diaspora issue. So I know I'm not giving you a lot of time to talk about this, but can you sort of talk about how expanding our idea of U.S. history out a little further into the Caribbean, into Mexico, complicates and maybe enriches our idea of race?
Well, David, you've already nailed it. When we talk about repatriation of Mexican workers in the 1930s during the Great Depression, when we talk about racial capitalism, this force which ensnares black and brown and also poor white workers, a system of divide and conquer, At the same time that repatriation was taking place in the Great Depression, African Americans were being lynched in droves. And so the same types of oppressive systems which come about because of capitalism, that's why I use the term racial capitalism in my book. In terms of labor history, I learned this term from Cedric Robinson. And the fact is that under capitalism, we will never find true freedom or liberation, because the capitalist system is designed to turn us into commodities, to commodify our labor. And this is why immigrant workers from the African diaspora, you mentioned African descent, black and brown workers were braceros, you know, were simply hired hands for capitalism. And until we switch out and find a new system, we're always going to be second-class citizens as workers, subjected to deportation, to immigration controls. You have 12 million disenfranchised workers in this country right now. They could be black, they could be brown, they're both. And it's a continuation of the Jim Crow system. And why does it continue? It continues because of the system of capitalism.
This is Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Jacob White. Today we've been talking to Dr. Paul Ortiz. I would highly encourage people to go check out his book. It has some really fascinating quotes that you might not have known some famous people said. It has really interesting anecdotes. Dr. Ortiz, thank you so much for joining us today. And, you know, we'll have to keep an eye out for next time another book comes out.
Thank you. Anytime, Jacob. Again, it was a pleasure and an honor. And thank you for the great work you're doing in your program.
All right. Thanks. We'll talk soon. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says there's stickers for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Hello, this is Mary Ariel for Safety First. First, Ohio Meatpacking Company, preying on workers from thepumphandle.org for June 28th. Workers' rights groups are connecting a federal worker safety inspection to an immigration raid at an Ohio company, which may make it more difficult for undocumented workers to come forward about workplace safety issues. Earlier in June, Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents in Ohio raided Freshmark, Inc. meat processing plants in Canton, Massillon, and Salem. The raids led to the arrest of 146 workers suspected of being in the country illegally. 2 weeks prior, the company was issued 13 citations and a $211,000 fine after a worker was killed by a meat skinning machine in December. Domingo Ramos, 49, a Guatemalan immigrant, was fatally injured when his foot got caught in a meat grinding auger. OSHA inspectors found the safety barrier on the auger had been removed. Just 2 months before Ramos' death, Freshmark paid a $4,900 OSHA penalty for exposing workers to an unguarded meat auger. As Christine Owens in the National Employment Law Project notes, the Trump administration's immigration policies will drive other immigrant workers subjected to substandard conditions further into the shadows and further deteriorate working conditions across already low-wage industries across this country. Next, what does a farm bill have to do with threatening chemical plant safety? From the confined space at jordanbarup.com/confined space for June 28th. A few weeks ago, the House of Representatives narrowly passed the Farm Bill, and a little notice sentence in this gigantic piece of legislation threatens the lives of those living near chemical facilities and the employees that work within them. As a gift to agricultural retailers, it contains language that would permanently stop OSHA from covering certain hazardous chemical facilities under its process safety management standard. 5 years ago, fire broke out at the West Fertilizer Company in West Texas. Emergency responders rushed toward the facility, which contained 40 to 60 tons of fertilizer-grade ammonium nitrate. 20 minutes later, a massive explosion ripped through the building, killing 12 responders and 3 others, injuring 252 and damaging or destroying 500 buildings. President Obama spoke at the funeral, and as a result of the West explosion, issued an executive order improving chemical facility safety and security, which told OSHA, EPA, and Homeland Security to cooperate more, update their chemical safety regulations, and told OSHA to identify any changes that needed to be made in the retail exemption to the PSM standard. West Fertilizer was interpreted as exempt because it was over 50% retail. To summarize confined space, the Agricultural Retailers Association, ARA, succeeded in convincing the House of Representatives to add language to this farm bill, ordering the Secretary of Labor to write the bad retail facility definition into the process safety management standard within 6 months. Instead of an interpretation, it would be part of the regulation. If the ARA and agricultural lobby succeed in permanently codifying the old 50% definition, the burden of the next workers and residents that are killed when a retail facility detonates will be on their hands. Finally, EPA gives thumbs up to new uses of asbestos from thepumphandle.org for June 14th. The 2016 amendments to the Toxic Substance Control Act, which had notable bipartisan support, paved the way for the U.S. to ban asbestos. But today's EPA is inviting businesses to use asbestos. That's the way the Pump Handle read an announcement in June from EPA Administrator Scott Pruitt. Exposure to asbestos causes more than 38,000 deaths from cancer alone in the U.S. every year. Tackling this problem requires a ban on asbestos. Scott Pruitt's EPA chose a very narrow definition of the conditions of use. It only includes the raw bulk chrysotile asbestos imported by the chloralkali industry, as well as asbestos-containing products such as brake blocks for use in oil drilling, etc. EPA is completely ignoring in its definition the millions of schools, hospitals, homes, and other structures that contain asbestos in wallboard, joint compound, insulation, floor tiles, ceiling texture. The second announcement is a proposed rule to address possible significant new uses of asbestos. Pruitt's proposal sends a dangerous message. EPA is suggesting that by the significant new use rule, or SNR, that asbestos can be used safely. It can't. But a SNR will provide a formal mechanism for a firm to get EPA's blessing to import, manufacture, and or use asbestos-containing products. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And this is Judy Ansel with the calendar. This Saturday, July 7th, Know on Prop A Day of Action from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 3600 Broadway in KCMO. Show up and they will give you something to do to help with that campaign. Our Revolution KC is having a meeting on Monday, July 9th from 7 to 9 p.m. at MRI Global, 425 Volker Boulevard in Kansas City, Missouri. KC Vote No on Prop A Rally and Walk. And this one is a big rally with special guest Liz Schuler, the Secretary-Treasurer of the National AFL-CIO. It's Tuesday, July 10th from 4:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Pipefitters Hall, 8600 Hillcrest. Film screening and discussion of Surveilling Black Lives Matter. This is a film about the surveillance, the police surveillance of the Black Lives Matter movement. Saturday, July 14th at 2 to 5 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut. That's sponsored by the Missouri ACLU. Surge, Standing Up for Racial Justice, Kansas City, July Mass Meeting, July 16th, 7 to 8:30 p.m. And if you have never been to one of their meetings, they do a Surge 101 at 6:30 p.m. And this is at St. Mark's Hope and Peace at 3800 Troost in Kansas City. And finally, Immigration Panel, We the People, All the People, Tuesday, July 24th, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. at Unity on the Plaza, 707 West 47th. That's our calendar. You can find it on our webpage, which is at heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also find our upcoming shows and our archived shows. And that's it for this edition of the Heartland Labor Forum. Tune in next week. Our two topics for the show are UPS, What Will Brown Do to You? This is about the contract negotiations at UPS. And then The Harvey Girls. It's a new book about those famous restaurant workers who worked in the train stations. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman.
standing side by side with working people, sweating for an honest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.